Memory is a shadow. Any cop trying to reconstruct a crime or an accident from the conflicting accounts of eyewitnesses knows it well. Is Potsy's black house like this? Something that casts no shadow? Dale's response, he has now turned full face to the peeling poster, working on it as seriously as he might work on a heart attack victim in the street, administering CPR right out of the manual until the ambulance arrives, suggests to Jack that it might be something like just that. 3 days ago, he wouldn't have allowed himself to consider such an idea. But 3 days ago, he hadn't returned to the territories. According to Potsy, this place got a reputation as a haunted house, even before it was completely built, Jack says, pressing a little. Help! Dale moves on to the sign about the AA and NA meetings. He examines the tape studiously, not looking at Jack. Doesn't ring the old chimeroo. Sure. One man almost bled to death. Another took a fall that paralyzed him. People complained. Listen to this, Dale, it's good. According to Potsy, people complained about losing their shadows. Couldn't see them even at midday with the sun shining full force. Isn't that something? Sure is, but I don't remember any stories like that. As Jack walks toward Dale, Dale moves away. Almost scutters away. Although Chief Gilbertson is not ordinarily a scuttering man, it's a little funny. A little sad. A little horrible. He doesn't know he's doing it. Jack's sure of that. There is a shadow. Jack sees it, and on some level, Dale knows he sees it. If Jack should force him too hard, Dale would have to see it too. And Dale doesn't want that. Because it's a bad shadow. Is it worse than a monster who kills children and then eats selected portions of their bodies? Apparently, part of Dale thinks so. I could make him see that shadow, Jack thinks coldly. Put my hands under his nose, my lily-scented hands, and make him see it. Part of him even wants to see it. The coppiceman part. Then another part of Jack's mind speaks up in the Speedy Parker drawl he now remembers from his childhood.
You could push him over the edge of a nervous breakdown, too, Jack. God knows he's close to one. After all the goings-on since the Erkenham boy got took, you want to chance that? And for what? He didn't know the name. About that, he was being straight.
Dale? Dale gives Jack a quick, bright glance, then looks away. The furtive quality in that quick peek sort of breaks Jack's heart.
What?
Let's go get a cup of coffee. At this change of subject, Dale's face fills with glad relief. He claps Jack on the shoulder.
Good idea.
God-pounding good idea right here and now, Jack thinks, then smiles. There's more than one way to skin a cat, and more than one way to find a black house. It's been a long day, best maybe to let this go, at least for tonight.
What about Railsback? Dale asks as they clatter down the stairs. You still want to talk to him?
You bet, Jack replies, heartily enough. But he holds out little hope for Andy Railsback, a picked witness who saw exactly what the fisherman wanted him to see. With one little exception, perhaps. The single slipper. Jack doesn't know if it will ever come to anything, but it might. In court, for instance, as an identifying link. This is never going to court. And you know it. It may not even finish in this His thoughts are broken by a wave of cheerful sound as they step into the combination ready room and dispatch center. The members of the French Landing Police Department are standing and applauding. Henry Layden is also standing and applauding. Dale joins in.
Jesus, guys, quit it, Jack says, laughing and blushing at the same time.
But he won't lie to himself, try to tell himself he takes no pleasure in that round of applause. He feels the warmth of them, can see the light of their regard. Those things aren't important, but it feels like coming home, and that is. When Jack and Henry step out of the police station an hour or so later, Beezer, Mouse, and Kaiser Bill are still there. The other two have gone back to the row to fill in the various old ladies on tonight's events.
Sawyer, Beezer says.
Yes, Jack says.
Anything we can do, man. Can you dig that? Anything.
Jack looks at the biker thoughtfully, wondering what his story is, other than grief, that is. A father's grief. Beezer's eyes remain steady on his. A little off to one side, Henry Layden stands with his head raised to smell the river fog, humming deep down in his throat. I'm going to look in on Irma's mom tomorrow around 11, Jack says. Do you suppose you and your friends could meet me in the sandbar around noon? She lives close to there, I understand. I'll buy you a round of lemonade. Beezer doesn't smile, but his eyes warm up slightly.
We'll be there.
That's good, Jack says.
Mind telling me why?
There's a place that needs finding.
Does it have to do with whoever killed Amy and the other kids?
Maybe. Beezer nods.
Maybe's good enough.
Jack drives back toward Norway Valley slowly, and not just because of the fog. Although it's still early in the evening, he is tired to the bone and has an idea that Henry feels the same way. Not because he's quiet. Jack has become used to Henry's occasional dormant stretches. No, it's the quiet in the truck itself. Under ordinary circumstances, Henry is a restless, compulsive radio tuner, running through the La Riviere stations, checking KDCU here in town, then ranging outward, hunting for Milwaukee, Chicago, maybe even Omaha, Denver, and St. Louis if conditions are right. An appetizer of bop here, a salad of spiritual music there, perhaps a dash of Perry Como way down at the foot of the dial. Hot diggity dog, diggity boom, what you do to me? Not tonight, though. Tonight, Henry just sits quiet on his side of the truck with his hands folded in his lap. At last, when they're no more than 2 miles from his driveway, Henry says,
No Dickens tonight, Jack. I'm going straight to bed.
The weariness in Henry's voice startles Jack, makes him uneasy. Henry doesn't sound like himself or any of his radio personae. At this moment, he just sounds old and tired, on the way to being used up. I am too, Jack agrees, trying not to let his concern show in his voice. Henry picks up on every vocal nuance. He's eerie that way.
What do you have in mind for the Thunder Five, may I ask?
I'm not entirely sure, Jack says. And perhaps because he's tired, he gets this untruth past Henry. He intends to start Beezer and his buddies looking for the place Potsy told him about, the place where shadows had a way of disappearing. At least, way back in the 70s they did. He had also intended to ask Henry if he's ever heard of a French Landing domicile called Black House. Not now, though. Not after hearing how beat Henry sounds. Tomorrow, maybe. Almost certainly, in fact, because Henry is too good a resource not to use. Best to let him recycle a little first, though. You have the tape, right? Henry pulls the cassette with the fisherman's 911 call on it partway out of his breast pocket, then puts it back.
Yes, Mother, but I don't think I can listen to a killer of small children tonight, Jack. Not even if you come in and listen with me.
Tomorrow will be fine, Jack says, hoping he isn't condemning another of French Landing's children to death by saying this.
You're not entirely sure of that.
No, Jack agrees. But you listening to that tape with dull ears could do more harm than good, I am sure of that. First thing in the morning, I promise. Henry's house is up ahead now. It looks lonely with only the one light on over the garage. But of course Henry doesn't need lights inside to find his way. Henry, are you going to be all right?
Yes, Henry says.
But to Jack he doesn't seem entirely sure. No rat tonight, Jack tells him firmly.
No.
Ditto the shake, the shook, the chic. Henry's lips lift in a small smile. Not even a George Rathbun promo for French Landing Chevrolet where price is king and you never pay a dime of interest for the first 6 months with approved credit. Straight to bed.
Me too, Jack says.
But an hour after lying down and putting out the lamp on his bedside table, Jack is still unable to sleep. faces and voices revolve in his mind like crazy clock hands, or a carousel on a deserted midway. Tansy Freneau, bring out the monster who killed my pretty baby. Beezer St. Pierre, we'll have to see how it shakes out, won't we? George Potter, that shit gets in and waits. My theory is that it never goes away, not really. Speedy, a voice from the distant past on the sort of telephone that was science fiction when Jack first met him.
Hidey-ho, traveling Jack. As one coppersman to another, son, I think you ought to visit Chief Gilbertson's private bathroom right now.
As one coppersman to another, right. And most of all, over and over again, Judy Marshall. You don't just say, I'm lost and I don't know how to get back. You keep on going. Yes, but keep on going where? Where? At last he gets up and goes out onto the porch with his pillow under his arm. The night is warm. In Norway Valley, where the fog was thin to begin with, the last remnants have now disappeared, blown away by a soft east wind. Jack hesitates, then goes on down the steps, naked except for his underwear. The porch is no good to him, though. It's where he found that hellish box with the sugar packet stamps. He walks past his truck, past the Bird Hotel, and into the north field. Above him are a billion stars. Crickets hum softly in the grass. His fleeing path through the hay and timothy has disappeared. Or maybe now he's entering the field in a different place. A little way in, he lies down on his back, puts the pillow under his head, and looks up at the stars. Just for a little while, he thinks. Just until all those ghost voices empty out of my head. Just for a little while. Thinking this, he begins to drowse. Thinking this, he goes over. Above his head, the pattern of the stars changes. He sees the new constellations form. What is that one, where the Big Dipper was a moment before? Is it the sacred Apopanax? Perhaps it is. He hears a low, pleasant, creaking sound and knows it's the windmill he saw when he flipped just this morning, 1,000 years ago. He doesn't need to look at it to be sure, any more than he needs to look at where his house was and see that it has once more become a barn. Creak, 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 vast wooden vanes turning in that same east wind. Only now the wind is infinitely sweeter, infinitely purer. Jack touches the waistband of his underpants and feels some rough weave. No jockey shorts in this world. His pillow has changed, too. Foam has become goose down, but it's still comfortable. More comfortable than ever, in truth. Sweet under his head. I'll catch him, Speedy, Jack Sawyer whispers up at the new shapes and the new stars. At least I'll try. He sleeps. When he awakens, it's early morning. The breeze is gone. In the direction from which it came, there's a bright orange line on the horizon. The sun is on its way. He's stiff, and his ass hurts, and he's damp with dew, but he's rested. The steady, rhythmic creaking is gone, but that doesn't surprise him. He knew from the moment he opened his eyes that he's in Wisconsin again. And he knows something else. He can go back any time he wants. The real coolie country, the deep coolie country, is just a wish and a motion away. This fills him with joy and dread in equal parts. Jack gets up and barefoots back to the house with his pillow under his arm. He guesses it's about 5 in the morning. Another 3 hours' sleep will make him ready for anything. On the porch steps, he touches the cotton of his jockey shorts. Although his skin is damp, the shorts are almost dry. Of course they are. For most of the hours he spent sleeping rough, as he spent so many nights that autumn when he was 12, they weren't on him at all. They were somewhere else. In the land of Apopanax, Jack says, and goes inside. 3 minutes later, he's asleep again, in his own bed. When he wakes at 8, with the sensible sun streaming in through his window, he could almost believe that his latest journey was a dream. But in his heart, he knows better. Chapter 18. Remember those news vans that drove into the parking lot behind the police station? And Wendell Green's contribution to the excitement before Officer Hrabowski's giant flashlight knocked him into the land of Nod? Once the crews inside the vans took in the seeming inevitability of a riot, we can be sure they rose to the occasion. For the next morning, their footage of the wild night dominates television screens across the state. By 9 o'clock, people in Racine and Milwaukee, people in Madison and Delafield, and people who live so far north in the state that they need satellite dishes to get any television at all, are looking up from their pancakes, their bowls of Special K, their fried eggs and their buttered English muffins, to watch a small, nervous-looking policeman finishing off a large, florid reporter's budding career as a demagogue by clocking him with a blunt instrument. And we may also be sure of one other matter. That nowhere is this footage watched as widely and compulsively as in French Landing and the neighboring communities of Centralia and Arden. Thinking about several matters at once, Jack Sawyer watches it all on a little portable TV placed on his kitchen counter. He hopes that Dale Gilbertson will not revoke Arnold Hrabowski's suspension, although he strongly suspects that the mad Hungarian will soon be back in uniform. Dale only thinks he wants him off the force for good. He is too soft-hearted to listen to Arnie's pleas. And after last night, even a blind man can see that Arnie is going to plead, without relenting. Jack also hopes that the awful Wendell Green will get fired or move away in disgrace. Reporters are not supposed to thrust themselves into their stories, and here is good old loudmouth Wendell baying for blood like a werewolf. However, Jack has the depressing feeling that Wendell Green will talk his way out of his present difficulties, that is, lie his way out of them, and go on being a powerful nuisance. And Jack is pondering Andy Railsback's description of the creepy old man trying the doorknobs on the third floor of the Nelson Hotel. There he was, the fisherman, given form at last. An old man in a blue robe and one slipper striped black and yellow, like a bumblebee. Andy Railsback had wondered if this unpleasant-looking old party had wandered away from the Maxton Elder Care Facility. That was an interesting notion, Jack thought. If Chummy Burnside is the man who planted the photographs in George Potter's room, Maxton's would be a perfect hidey-hole for him. Wendell Green is watching the news on the Sony in his hotel room. He cannot take his eyes off the screen, although what he sees there afflicts him with a mixture of feelings, anger, shame, and humiliation that makes his stomach boil. The knot on his head throbs, and every time he witnesses that poor excuse for a cop sneaking up behind him with his flashlight raised, he pushes his fingers into the thick, curly hair at the back of his head and gently palpates it. The damn thing feels about the size of a ripe tomato and just as ready to burst. He's lucky not to have a concussion. That pipsqueak could have killed him. Okay, maybe he went a little bit over the edge. Maybe he took a tiny step across a professional boundary. He never claimed to be perfect. The local news guys, they piss him off, all that guff about Jack Sawyer. Who is the top guy covering the fisherman story? Who has been all over it from day one, telling the citizens what they need to know? Who's been putting himself on the line day after crummy goddamn day? Who gave the guy his name? Not those blow-dried airheads Bucky and Stacy, those wannabe news reporters and local anchors who smile into the camera to show off their capped teeth, that's for sure. Wendell Green is a legend around here, a star, the closest thing to a giant of journalism ever to come out of western Wisconsin. Even over in Madison, the name Wendell Green stands for, well, unquestioned excellence. And if the name Wendell Green is like the gold standard now, just wait until he rides the fisherman's blood-spattered shoulders all the way to a Pulitzer Prize. So tomorrow morning, Sunday, he has to go into the office and pacify his editor. Big deal. It isn't the first time and it won't be the last. Good reporters make waves. Nobody admits it, but that's the deal. That's the fine print nobody reads until it's too late. When he walks into his editor's office, he knows what he's going to say. Biggest story of the day, and did you see any other reporters there? And when he has the editor eating out of his hand again, which will take about 10 minutes flat, he intends to drop in on a Goltz's salesman named Fred Marshall. One of Wendell's most valuable sources has suggested that Mr. Marshall has some interesting information about his special, special baby, the fisherman case. Arnold Hrabowski, now a hero to his darling wife Paula, is watching the news in a post-coital glow and thinking that she is right. He really should call Chief Gilbertson and ask to be taken off suspension. Wondering with half his mind where he might look for George Potter's old adversary, Dale Gilbertson watches Bucky and Stacy cut away yet again to the spectacle of the mad Hungarian taking care of Wendell Green and thinks that he really should reinstate the little guy. Would you look at the beautiful swing Arnie took? Dale can't help it. That swing really brightens up his day. It's like watching Mark McGuire, like watching Tiger Woods. Alone in her dark little house off the highway, Wanda Kinderling, to whom we have made passing mention from time to time, is listening to the radio. Why is she listening to the radio? Some months ago, she had to decide between paying her cable bill and buying another half-gallon of Aristocrat vodka, and sorry, Bucky and Stacy, but Wanda followed her bliss. She went with her heart. Without cable service, her television set brings in little more than snow and a heavy dark line that scrolls up over her screen in an endless loop. Wanda always hated Bucky and Stacy anyhow, along with almost everyone else on television, especially if they looked content and well-groomed. She has a special loathing for the hosts of morning news programs and network anchors. Wanda has not been content or well-groomed since her husband, Thorny, was accused of terrible crimes he could never, ever have committed by that high and mighty show-off Jack Sawyer. Jack Sawyer ruined her life, and Wanda is not about to forgive or forget. That man trapped her husband. He set him up. He smeared Thorny's innocent name and packed him off to jail just to make himself look good. Wanda hopes they never catch the fishermen, because the fishermen is exactly what they deserve, those dirty bastards. Play dirty, you are dirty, and people like that can go straight to the deepest bowels of hell. That's what Wanda Kinderling thinks. The fisherman is retribution. That's what Wanda thinks. Let him kill 100 brats, let him kill 1,000, and after that he can start in on their parents. Thorny could not have killed those sluts down there in Los Angeles. Those were sex murders, and Thorny had no interest in sex, thank the Lord. The rest of him grew up, but his man part never did. His thingy was about the size of his little finger. It was impossible for him to care about nasty women and sex things. But Jack Sawyer lived in Los Angeles, didn't he? So why couldn't he have killed those sluts, those whores, and blamed it all on Thorny? The newscaster describes former Lieutenant Sawyer's actions of the previous night, and Wanda Kinderling spits up bile, grabs the glass from her bedside table, and douses the fire in her guts with 3 inches of vodka. Gorg, who would seem a natural visitor to the likes of Wanda, pays no attention to the news, for he is far away in far away. In his bed at Maxton's, Charles Burnside is enjoying dreams not precisely his, for they emanate from another being, from elsewhere, and depict a world he has never seen on his own. Ragged, enslaved children plod on their bleeding footsies past leaping flames, turning giant wheels that turn yet larger wheels, oh-ho, aha, that power the beautiful engines of destruction, mounting, mounting to the black and red sky. The big combination. An acrid stink of molten metal and something truly vile, something like dragon urine, perfumes the air, as does the leaden stench of despair. Scarlet demons with thick, flickering tails whip the children along. A din of clattering and banging, of crashing and enormous thuds punishes the ears. These are the dreams of Bernie's dearest friend and loving master, Mr. Munshun, a being of endless and perverse delight. Down past the end of Daisy Wing, across the handsome lobby, and through Rebecca Vilas's little cubicle, Chipper Maxton is concerned with matters considerably more mundane. The little TV on a shelf over the safe broadcasts the wondrous image of mad Hungarian Hrabowski clobbering Wendell Green with a nice clean sweep of his heavy-duty flashlight, but Chipper barely notices the splendid moment. He has to come up with the $13,000 he owes his bookie, and he has only about half of that sum. Yesterday, lovely Rebecca drove to Monroe to withdraw most of what he had stashed there, and he can use about $2,000 from his own account as long as he replaces it before the end of the month. That leaves about $6,000, an amount that will call for some seriously creative bookkeeping. Fortunately, creative bookkeeping is a specialty of Chipper's, and when he begins to think of his options, he sees his current difficulty as an opportunity. After all, he went into business in the first place to steal as much money as possible, didn't he? Apart from being serviced by Miss Vilas, stealing is about the only activity that makes him truly happy. The amount is almost irrelevant. As we have seen, Chipper derives as much pleasure from conning chump change out of the visiting relatives after the Strawberry Fest as from screwing the government out of $10,000 or $15,000. The thrill lies in getting away with it. So he needs $6,000. Why not take $10,000? That way he can leave his own account untouched and still have an extra $2,000 to play with. He has two sets of books on his computer, and he can easily draw the money from the company's bank account without setting off bells during his next state audit, which is coming up in about a month. Unless the auditors demand the bank records, and even then there are a couple of tricks he can use. It's too bad about the audit, though. Chipper would like to have a little more time to paper over the cracks. Losing the $13,000 wasn't the problem, he thinks. The problem was that he lost it at the wrong time. In order to keep everything clear in his head, Chipper pulls his keyboard toward him and tells the computer to print out complete statements of both sets of books for the past month. By the time the auditors show up, baby, those pages will have been fed into the shredder and come out as macaroni. Let us move from one form of insanity to another. After the owner of the Holiday Trailer Park has extended a trembling index finger to point out the Freneau residence, Jack drives toward it on the dusty path with gathering doubts. Tansy's Airstream is the last and least maintained of a row of four. Two of the others have flowers in a bright border around them, and the third has been dressed up with striped green awnings that make it look more like a house. The fourth trailer displays no signs of decoration or improvement. Dying flowers and skimpy weeds straggle in the beaten earth surrounding it. The shades are pulled down. An air of misery and waste hangs about it, along with a quality Jack might define if he stopped to consider it. As slippage. In no obvious way, the trailer looks wrong. Unhappiness has distorted it, as it can distort a person. And when Jack gets out of his truck and walks toward the cinder blocks placed before the entrance, his doubts increase. He can no longer be sure why he has come to this place. It occurs to Jack that he can give Tansy Freneau nothing but his pity, and this thought makes him uneasy. Then it occurs to him that these doubts mask his real feelings, which have to do with the discomfort the trailer arouses in him. He does not want to enter that thing. Everything else is a rationalization. He has no choice but to keep moving forward. His eyes find the welcome mat, a reassuring touch of the ordinary world he can feel already disappearing around him. And he steps up onto the topmost board and knocks on the door. Nothing happens. Maybe she really is still asleep and would prefer to stay that way. If he were Tansy, he would stay in bed as long as possible. If he were Tansy, he'd stay in bed for weeks. Once more, pushing away his reluctance, Jack raps on the door again and says, "Tansy, are you up?" A little voice from within says, "Up where?" "Uh-oh," Jack thinks, and says, "Out of bed. I'm Jack Sawyer, Tansy. We met last night." I'm helping the police, and I told you I'd come over today. He hears footsteps moving toward the door.
Are you the man who gave me the flowers? He was a nice man.
That was me. A lock clicks, and the knob revolves. The door cracks open. A sliver of a faintly olive-skinned face and a single eye shine out of the inner darkness.
It is you. Come in fast. Fast.
She steps back, opening the door just wide enough for him to pass through. As soon as he is inside, she slams it shut and locks it again. The molten light burning at the edges of the curtains and the window shades deepens the darkness of the long trailer's interior. One soft lamp burns above the sink, and another, just as low, illuminates a little table otherwise occupied by a bottle of coffee brandy, a smeary glass decorated with a picture of a cartoon character, and a scrapbook. The circle of light cast by the lamp extends to take in half of a low, fabric-covered chair next to the table. Tansy Freneau pushes herself off the door and takes two light, delicate steps toward him. She tilts her head and folds her hands together beneath her chin. The eager, slightly glazed expression in her eyes dismays Jack. By even the widest, most comprehensive definition of sanity, this woman is not sane. He has no idea what to say to her.
Would you care to sit down?
With a hostessy wave of her hand, she indicates a high-backed wooden chair. If it's all right with you.
Why wouldn't it be all right? I'm going to sit down in my chair. Why shouldn't you sit down in that one?
Thank you, Jack says, and sits down, watching her glide back to the door to check the lock. Satisfied, Tansy gives him a brilliant smile and pads back to her chair, moving almost with the duck-waddle grace of a ballerina. When she lowers herself to the chair, he says,
Are you afraid of someone who might come here, Tansy?
Is there someone you want to keep locked out?
Oh, yes,
she says, and leans forward, pulling her eyebrows together in an exaggerated display of little girl seriousness.
But it isn't a someone. It's a thing. And I'm never, never going to let him in my house again. Not ever. But I'll let you in because you're a very nice man, and you gave me those beautiful flowers. And you're very handsome, too.
Is Gorg the thing you want to keep out, Tansy? Are you afraid of Gorg?
Yes, she says primly. Would you care for a cup of tea?
No, thank you.
Well, I'm going to have some. It's very, very good tea. It tastes sort of like coffee.
She raises her eyebrows and gives him a bright, questioning look. He shakes his head. Without moving from her chair, Tansy pours two fingers of the brandy into her glass and sets the bottle back down on the table. The figure on her glass Jack sees is Scooby-Doo. Tansy sips from the glass.
Yummy. Do you have a girlfriend? I could be your girlfriend, you know, especially if you gave me more of those lovely flowers. I put them in a vase.
She pronounces the word like a parody of a Boston matron. Vase.
See?
On the kitchen counter, the lilies of the vale droop in a mason jar half filled with water. Removed from the territories, they do not have long to live. This world, Jack supposes, is poisoning them faster than they are able to deal with. Every ounce of goodness they yield to their surroundings subtracts from their essence. Tansy, he realizes, has been kept afloat on the residue of the territories remaining in the lilies. When they die, her protective little girl persona will crumble into dust, and her madness may engulf her. That madness came from Gorg. He'd bet his life on it.
I do have a boyfriend, but he doesn't count. His name is Lester Moon. Beezer and his friends call him Stinky Cheese. But I don't know why. Lester isn't all that stinky, at least not when he's sober.
Tell me About Gorg, Jack says. Extending her little finger away from the Scooby-Doo glass, Tansy takes another sip of coffee brandy. She frowns.
Oh, that's a real icky thing to talk about.
I want to know about him, Tansy. If you help me, I can make sure he never bothers you again.
Really?
And you'd be helping me find the man who killed your daughter.
I can't talk about that now. It's too upsetting.
Tansy flutters her free hand over her lap as if sweeping off a crumb. Her face contracts, and a new expression moves into her eyes. For a second, the desperate, unprotected Tansy rises to the surface, threatening to explode in a madness of grief and rage. Does Gorg look like a person, or like something else? Tansy shakes her head from side to side with great slowness. She is composing herself again, reinstating a personality that can ignore her real emotions.
Gorg does not look like a person. Not at all.
You said he gave you the feather you were wearing. Does he look like a bird?
Gorg doesn't look like a bird. He is a bird. And do you know what kind?
She leans forward again, and her face takes on the expression of a 6-year-old girl about to tell the worst thing she knows.
A raven. That's what he is, a big old raven. All black. But not shiny black.
Her eyes widen with the seriousness of what she has to say.
He came from Night's Plutonian Shore. That's from a poem Mrs. Normandy taught us in the 6th grade, The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe.
Tansy straightens up, having passed on this nugget of literary history. Jack guesses that Mrs. Normandy probably wore the same satisfied pedagogic expression that is now on Tansy's face, but without the bright, unhealthy glaze in Tansy's eyes.
Night's Plutonian Shore is not part of this world, Tansy continues. Did you know that? It's alongside this world, and outside it. You need to find a door if you want to go there.
This is like talking to Judy Marshall, Jack abruptly realizes, but a Judy without the depth of soul and the unbelievable courage that rescued her from madness. The instant that Judy Marshall comes into his mind, he wants to see her again, so strongly that Judy feels like the one essential key to the puzzle all around him. And if she is the key, she is also the door the key opens. Jack wants to be out of the dark, warped atmosphere of Tansy's airstream. He wants to put off the Thunder 5 and speed up the highway and over the hill to Arden and the gloomy hospital where radiant Judy Marshall has found freedom in a locked mental ward.
But I don't ever want to find that door because I don't want to go there, Tansy says in a sing-song voice. Night's Plutonian Shore is a bad world. Everything's on fire there.
How do you know that?
Gorg told me,
she whispers. Tansy's gaze skitters away from him and fastens on the Scooby-Doo glass.
Gorg likes fire, but not because it makes him warm. Because it burns things up, and that makes him happy. Gorg said...
She shakes her head and lifts the glass to her mouth. Instead of drinking from it, she tilts the liquid toward the lip of the glass and laps at it with her tongue. Her eyes slide up to meet his again.
I think my tea is magic.
I bet you do, Jack thinks, and his heart nearly bursts for delicate lost Tansy.
You can't cry in here, she tells him. You looked like you wanted to cry, but you can't. Mrs. Normandy doesn't allow it. You can kiss me, though. Do you want to kiss me?
Of course I do, he says, but Mrs. Normandy doesn't allow kissing either.
Oh, well,
Tansy laps again at her drink.
We can do it later when she leaves the room. And you can put your arms around me like Lester Moon, and everything Lester does, you can do with me.
Thank you, Jack says. Tansy,
Can you tell me some of the other things Gorg said? She cants her head and pushes her lips in and out.
He said he came here through a burning hole with folded back edges. And he said I was a mother and I had to help my daughter. In the poem, her name is Lenore, but her real name is Irma. And he said a mean old man ate her leg. But there were worse things that could have happened to my Irma.
For a couple of seconds, Tansy seems to recede into herself, to vanish behind her stationary surface. Her mouth remains half open. She does not even blink. When she returns from where she has gone, it is like watching a statue slowly come to life. Her voice is almost too soft to be heard.
I was supposed to fix that old man. Fix him but good. Only you gave me my beautiful lilies, and he wasn't the right man, was he?
Jack feels like screaming.
He said there were worse things,
Tansy says, in a whisper of disbelief.
But he didn't say what they were. He showed me instead. And when I saw, I thought my eyes burned up, even though I could still see.
What did you see?
A big, big place, all made of fire,
Tansy says,
going way high up.
She falls silent, and an internal trembler runs through her, beginning in her face and moving down and out through her fingers.
Irma isn't there. No, she isn't. She got dead and a mean old man ate her leg. He sent me a letter, but I never got it. So Gorg read it to me. I don't want to think about that letter.
She sounds like a little girl describing something she has heard about third hand or has invented. A thick curtain lies between Tansy and what she has seen and heard, and that curtain allows her to function. Jack again wonders what will happen to her when the lilies die.
And now, she says, if you're not going to kiss me, it's time you left. I want to be alone for a while.
Surprised by her decisiveness, Jack stands up and begins to say something polite and meaningless. Tansy waves him toward the door. Outside, the air seems heavy with bad odors and unseen chemicals. The lilies from the territories retained more power than Jack had imagined, enough to sweeten and purify Tansy's air. The ground beneath Jack's feet has been baked dry, and a parched sourness hangs in the atmosphere. Jack has nearly to force himself to breathe as he walks toward his truck. But the more he breathes, the more quickly he will readjust to the ordinary world. His world, though now it feels poisoned. He wants to do one thing only. Drive up Highway 93 to Judy Marshall's lookout point and keep on going, through Arden and into the parking lot, past the hospital doors, past the barriers of Dr. Spiegelman and Warden Jane Bond, until he can find himself once again in the life-giving presence of Judy Marshall herself. He almost thinks he loves Judy Marshall. Maybe he does love her. He knows he needs her. Judy is his door and his key. His door, his key. Whatever that means, it is the truth. All right, the woman he needs is married to the extremely nice Fred Marshall, but he doesn't want to marry her. In fact, he doesn't even want to sleep with her. Not exactly. He just wants to stand before her and see what happens. Something will happen, that's for sure. But when he tries to picture it, all he sees is an explosion of tiny red feathers. Hardly the image he was hoping for. Feeling unsteady, Jack props himself on the cab of his truck with one hand while he grabs the door handle with the other. Both surfaces sear his hands, and he waves them in the air for a little while. When he gets into the cab, the seat is hot, too. He rolls down his window, and with a twinge of loss, notices that the world smells normal to him again. It smells fine. It smells like summer. Where is he going to go? That is an interesting question, he thinks. But after he gets back on the road and travels no more than 100 feet, the low, gray, wooden shape of the sand bar appears on his left. And without hesitating, he turns into the absurdly extensive parking lot as if he knew where he was going all along. Looking for a shady spot, Jack cruises around to the back of the building and sees the bar's single hint of landscaping, a broad maple tree that rises out of the asphalt at the far end of the lot. He guides the Ram into the maple shadow and gets out, leaving the windows cranked down. Waves of heat ripple upward from the only other two cars in the lot. It is 11:20 a.m. He is getting hungry, too, since his breakfast consisted of a cup of coffee and a slice of toast smeared with marmalade, and that was 3 hours ago. Jack has the feeling that the afternoon is going to be a long one. He might as well have something to eat while he waits for the bikers. The back door of the sand bar opens onto a narrow restroom alcove that leads into a long rectangular space with a gleaming bar at one side and a row of substantial wooden booths on the other. Two big pool tables occupy the middle of the room, and a jukebox stands set back against the wall between them. At the front of the room, a big television screen hangs where it can be seen by everyone, suspended 8 or 9 feet above the clean wooden floor. The sound has been muted on a commercial that never quite identifies the purpose of its product. After the glare of the parking lot, the bar seems pleasantly dark, and while Jack's eyes adjust, the few low lamps appear to send out hazy beams of light. The bartender, whom Jack takes to be the famous Lester Stinky Cheese Moon, looks up once as Jack enters, then returns to the copy of the Herald folded open on the bar. When Jack takes a stool a few feet to his right, he looks up again. Stinky Cheese is not as awful as Jack had expected. He is wearing a clean shirt, only a few shades whiter than his round, small-featured face and his shaven head. Moon has the unmistakable air, half professional and half resentful, of someone who has taken over the family business and suspects he could have done better elsewhere. Jack's intuition tells him that this sense of weary frustration is the source of his nickname among the bikers, because it gives him the look of one who expects to encounter a nasty smell any minute now. "Can I get something to eat here?" Jack asks him. "It's all listed on the board." The bartender turns sideways and indicates a white board with movable letters that spell out the menu. Hamburger, cheeseburger, hot dog, bratwurst, kielbasa, sandwiches, french fries, onion rings. The man's gesture is intended to make Jack feel unobservant, and it works. "Sorry, I didn't see the sign." The bartender shrugs. "Cheeseburger, medium with fries, please. Lunch don't start until 11:30, which it says on the board, see?" Another half-mocking gesture toward the sign. "But Mom is setting up in back. I could give her the order now and she'll start in on it when she's ready." Jack thanks him, and the bartender glances up at the television screen and walks down to the end of the bar and disappears around a corner. A few seconds later, he returns, looks up at the screen, and asks Jack what he would like to drink. "Ginger ale," Jack says. Watching the screen, Lester Moon squirts ginger ale from a nozzle into a beer glass and pushes the glass toward Jack. Then he slides his hand down the bar to pick up the remote control and says, "Hope you don't mind, but I was watching this old movie. Pretty funny." He punches a button on the remote, and from over his left shoulder, Jack hears his mother's voice say, "Looks like Smokey's coming in late today. I wish that little rascal would learn how to handle his liquor." Before he can turn sideways to face the screen, Lester Moon is asking him if he remembers Lily Cavanaugh. "Oh, yes. I always liked her when I was a kid." "Same here," Jack says. As Jack had known instantly, the movie is The Terror of Deadwood Gulch, a 1950 comic western in which the then-famous and still fondly remembered Bill Towns, a sort of poor man's Bob Hope, played a cowardly gambler and card sharp who arrives in the little Potemkin community of Deadwood Gulch, Arizona, and is soon mistaken for a notorious gunfighter. As the beautiful, quick-witted owner of a saloon called the Lazy Eight, the lively center of village social life, Lily Cavanaugh is much appreciated by the crowd of cowpokes, loungers, ranchers, merchants, lawmen, and riffraff who fill her place every night. She makes her patrons check their revolvers at the door and mind their manners, which tend toward the Apopanax. In the scene playing now, which is about half an hour into the movie, Lily is alone in her saloon trying to get rid of a persistent bee. A bee for the queen of the bees, Jack thinks and smiles. At the buzzing nuisance, Lily flaps a cleaning rag, a fly swatter, a mop, a broom, a gun belt. The bee eludes her every effort, zooming here and there, from the bar to a card table, to the top of a whiskey bottle, the tops of three other bottles all in a row, the lid of the upright piano, often waiting while its adversary comes sneaking up by subtle indirection, then taking off a second before the latest weapon slams down. It is a lovely little sequence that verges on slapstick, and when Jackie was 666, or maybe 7, half hysterical with laughter at the sight of his competent mother failing repeatedly to vanquish this flying annoyance, and suddenly curious as to how the movie guys had made the insect do all these things, his mother had explained that it was not a real bee, but an enchanted one produced by the special effects department. Lester Moon says, "I could never figure out how they got the bee to go where they wanted. Like, what did they do, train it?" First they filmed her alone on the set, Jack says, having concluded that after all, Stinky Cheese is a pretty decent fellow with great taste in actresses. Special effects put the bee in later. It isn't a real bee, it's a drawing, an animation. You really can't tell, can you? No way. Are you sure? How do you know that, anyhow? I read it in a book somewhere, Jack says, using his all-purpose response to such questions. Resplendent in fancy card-sharp get-up, Bill Towns saunters through the Lazy Eight swinging doors and leers at its proprietress without noticing that she is edging toward the bee now once again installed upon the shiny bar. He has romance in mind, and he swaggers when he walks. "I see you came back for more, hot shot," Lily says. "You must like the place." "Baby, this is the sweetest joint west of the wide Missouri. Reminds me of the place where I beat Black Jack McGurk to the draw. Poor Black Jack, he never did know when to fold him." With a noise like the revving of a B-52, the enchanted bee, a creature of fiction inside the fiction, launches itself at Bill Towns's slickly behatted head. The comedian's face turns rubbery with comic terror. He waves his arms, he jigs, he screeches. The enchanted bee performs aeronautic stunts around the panicky pseudo-gunfighter. Towns's splendid hat falls off, his hair disarranges itself. He edges toward a table and with a final flurry of hand-waving, dives under it and begs for help.